The urge within the race towards whiteness and to be as little Negro and as much American as possible was the mountain standing in the way of any true Negro art, wrote Langston Hughes. Hughes was reacting to the words of another poet who had told him, "I want to be a poet, not a Negro poet," probably referring to County Cullen, Du Bois's future son-in-law. Hughes went on to describe the upbringing of the young poet in a typical black middle-income home where the mother often told misbehaving children, "Don't be like niggers," and the father married the lightest woman he could find and told them, "Look how well a white man does things." In the home, they read white newspapers, they attended white theaters and schools, and they favored churches for light-skinned blacks. They aspired to Nordic manners, Nordic faces, Nordic hair, Nordic art, said Hughes, as the whisper of "I want to be white" runs silently through their minds. This was a very high mountain indeed for the would-be racial artist to climb in order to discover himself. It stopped the Negro artist from seeing the beauty of his own people, Hughes added. In the lives of the low-down folks, who did not particularly care whether they are like white folks, there was sufficient matter to furnish a black artist, as his friend Zora Neale Hurston's career would show. The Negro artist did not have to touch on the relations between Negroes and whites. The only duty Hughes dropped onto the younger Negro artist was to change through the force of his art that old whispering, "I want to be white," hidden in the aspirations of his people, to "Why should I want to be white? I am a Negro, and beautiful, and ugly, too." If Langston Hughes focused his anti-racist creative energy on persuading black people away from assimilationist ideas, and if County Cullen focused his assimilationist creative energy on persuading white people away from segregationist ideas, then Du Bois remained doubly focused on both. But in 1926, Du Bois's attention veered much more into persuading white people. And so Du Bois viewed Hughes's essay, and then his endorsement of Carl Van Vechten's Nigger Heaven, released in August 1926, as utterly traitorous. Van Vechten was the Harlem Renaissance's most ubiquitous white patron, a man as curiously passionate about being around and showing off black people as zookeepers are about being around and showing off their exotic pets. In the past few years, European artists arriving in New York had been calling on Van Vechten to take them on the safari of Harlem, as the tourists and tour guide more or less understood it. Now, Van Vechten gave them the tour in a book, Nigger Heaven. Van Vechten's book is a melodramatically tragic love story of boy meets girl, but with all that genre's affection, seduction, obstruction, betrayal, and death winding through the pitfalls of racial discrimination. It portrays the vivaciously lurid debauchery of the jazz clubs and cabarets of black commoners, the solemn pretentiousness of the finely lit homes of educated, assimilated black elites, and the politically correct intellectuals who debated the race problem. The bitter racial line of negative black reviews and positive white reviews could not have been starker. Nigger Heaven, from its outrageous title to the outrageous extremes of black decadence and pomposity it delineated, felt like a blow in the face to W.E.B. Du Bois and the Talented Tenth. It was nearly as powerful a blow as the one that had been delivered by William Hannibal Thomas's The American Negro in 1901. A black professorial character in Nigger Heaven claims, in a dig at media suasion, that the advance of black artists in white circles will not change white opinions, because the white people they meet will regard them as geniuses, in other words, exceptions. Nothing worse rained down from Nigger Heaven than Van Vechten's outrageously untrue indictment of assimilated blacks as spoiled, along the same line of thought that globe-trotting racists like to use to frame tropical exotic lands as being spoiled by white developers. The virginal and pure and assimilated gospel singer Mary Love, for example, had lost or forfeited her birthright, this primitive birthright, that all civilized races were struggling to get back to, Van Vechten wrote in Nigger Heaven. She mourned that loss and yearned to rediscover it. This love of drums, of exciting rhythms, this warm, sexual emotion. "We are all savages," she repeated to herself, "all, apparently, but me." In reducing Negro artists' gifts to their racial nature, Van Vechten was implying that there was no intellectual ingenuity, or constant rehearsing, or endless refinement of the ear, needed to master the sophisticated grandeur of music and dance performance in blues and jazz. Blacks were natural singers and dancers and musicians, and all those black people who could not sing, dance, and play were apparently not really black. It was an idea later reinforced by John Martin, who became America's first major dance critic when he joined the New York Times in 1927. He reasoned that for blacks, the ability to dance was intrinsic and innate. They had natural racial rhythm and struggled to learn the more technical dance styles such as ballet. What Van Vechten and Martin posed as assimilated blacks' tragic dilemma was stingingly racist. They could never quite reach the greatness of white civilization, but they were running away from the greatness of their natural savagery. Van Vechten made Harlem seem so exciting and exotic that white readers made Nigger Heaven a runaway bestseller. Whites started pouring into Harlem, into black America, to see, hear, and touch the supposed primitive superior birthright of black artistry and sexuality. They flooded into clubs like Harlem's Jungle, or went over to watch an exhibition of the newly established Harlem Globetrotters. In 1927, these black showmen started running up and down the basketball court in a natural rhythm, emitting jungle sounds and wild bursts of laughter like frivolous, dishonest, lazy children in need of mature white handling. They found that handler in the club's founder, Abe Saperstein. In Nigger Heaven, and in the blues art form in general, black commoners were sometimes portrayed before white Americans as sexual, uneducated, lazy, crude, immoral, and criminal. This image brought on more debates about uplift and media suasion. Many black elites agonized every time they saw negative black portrayals in the media, convinced that these portrayals were reinforcing stereotypes and constituted the lifeblood of racist ideas. They religiously believed that if only whites saw more positive black portrayals, ones that were chaste, educated, refined, moral, and law-abiding, then racist ideas would wither away and die. And although black elites did not want whites to view the negative media portrayals of black commoners as representative of black elites like them, they themselves often viewed such portrayals as representative of black commoners. Black commoners and their elite anti-racist defenders, in contrast, saw the diverse truth of black people in the portrayals and in their artistry. They cared little about the impact on racist ideas and enjoyed Nigger Heaven and the blues. And they should not have cared. The Americans who were generalizing the negative behavior individual black characters in Nigger Heaven or the blues were showing that they had already consumed racist ideas. The talented Tenth's attempt at media suasion was a lost cause from the start. While negative portrayals of black people often reinforced racist ideas, positive portrayals did not necessarily weaken racist ideas. The positive portrayals were simply dismissed as extraordinary Negroes, and the negative portrayals were generalized as typical. Even if these racial reformers managed to one day replace all negative portrayals with positive portrayals in the mainstream media, then like addicts, racists would then turn to other suppliers. Before Nigger Heaven and the blues, racists found their supply of reinforcing drugs in the minstrel shows, in science, in generalizing any negativities they saw in their interactions with any black person. The cross-class, cross-generational, cross-ideological portrayals debate was on in the 1920s, and it was centered in the portrayals of blues and then jazz, in Nigger Heaven and then in Claude McKay's Home to Harlem in 1928. Home to Harlem, the first black-authored bestseller, made Du Bois feel distinctly like taking a bath. Raging, Du Bois released his own Dark Princess, a romance, that year, portraying strong, intelligent women and sensitive, intelligent men, as he always did in his fiction, seemingly unaware that he, too, was reinforcing racist ideas. Du Bois was reinforcing assimilationist ideas, and in the 1920s, these ideas were advancing on American Northern minds, particularly among intellectuals. The acceptance of those ideas appeared to be the byproduct of the ongoing Great Migration of black folk out of the segregated South, the ongoing activism of new Negroes to desegregate the North and Northern scholarship, and the ongoing reproduction of black folk. The advance was not the byproduct of talented Tenth activists successfully persuading racist Americans that black domestics and farmers could live and work in the industrial North. Migrants to the North were forcibly breaking out of the confines of agricultural and domestic labor in the segregated South, and thus the racist ideas justifying those confines. In 1928, some of the leading race scholars came together to publish a landmark special issue on the Negro in the prestigious Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. Over the past 15 years, the Annals editor wrote, students of race as well as laymen have had to discard or even reverse many of their theories. The Great Migration had upset the widely accepted theory that segregating blacks in their tropical nature would solve the Negro problem. Black people of both sexes had demonstrated their ability to work in industrial occupations formerly thought to be beyond them. And the theory of poor black health causing extinction through degeneracy, the editor said, had suffered severe shocks. The old theories concerning absorption through biological assimilation have been unable in their original form to withstand the tests of research. Moreover, black ethical and moral standards are developing, the editor beamed, in assimilationist fashion. In short, the most prestigious social scientific journal in American academia symbolically announced the retreat of segregationist ideas. Segregationists had dominated American academe for nearly a century, since the pre-Civil War days of Samuel Morton and the Polygenesis. The special issue comprised a star-studded lineup of black and white male scholars, including W.E.B. Du Bois, Robert Park, and esteemed University of Pennsylvania sociologist Thorsten Sellen. Sellen disclosed the unreliability of racial crime statistics for assessing actual levels of crime. The colored criminal does not, as a rule, enjoy the racial anonymity which cloaks the offenses of individuals of the white race, Sellen wrote. In setting the hallmark of his color upon him, his individuality is in a sense submerged, and instead of a mere thief, robber, or murderer, he becomes a representative of his race. And yet Sellen cannot go as far as anti-racist New Negro criminologists and concede that the Negro's real criminality is lower or as low as the whites. Walter White, who on several occasions in the 1920s courageously passed to conduct brilliant NAACP investigations of Southern lynching parties, suggested that the color line existed not only in America, but also in Europe and South Africa, and in approximately the same proportions. Possibly to remain politically correct, he did not mention communist Russia, where state views on race did not approximate the other colonizing European nations. In the summer of 1928, the Sixth Congress of the Soviet Comintern declared that the party must come out openly and unreservedly for the right of Negroes to national self-determination in the southern states, where the Negroes form a majority of the population. American communists were stirred to action. The central slogan of the party should be, "Abolition of the whole system of race discrimination," blared the communist. For black labor activists, the Comintern's 1928 statement, an expanded version in 1930, sounded like a lifeline for drowning black labor. When American Federation of Labor head Samuel Gompers died in 1924, William Green continued his policy of saying blacks were welcome in the AFL and denying the existence of racial discrimination in the ranks of labor unions. In doing so, Green effectively blamed blacks for segregated unions and for their disproportionate placement as the bottom of labor pools. Claude G. Bowers probably did not read the essays in the special issue of Annals. His attention was focused elsewhere in November 1928 on the election returns. Bowers was the editor of the New York Post, a prominent biographer of Thomas Jefferson, and as aggressively loyal to the Democratic Party as anyone. Angrily watching the GOP snatch southern states in the presidential election, he decided to remind white southerners that the Republicans had been responsible for the horror of Reconstruction. His best-selling book, published in 1929, was called The Tragic Era, The Revolution After Lincoln. Historians have shrunk from the unhappy tasks of showing us the torture chambers, he said, where guiltless southern whites were literally tortured by vicious black Republicans. We will never know just how many Americans read The Tragic Era and then saw The Birth of a Nation again at their local theaters, and then pledged never to vote again for the Republican Party, never to miss a lynching bash, and never to consider desegregation. In short, never to do anything that might revive the specter of blacks voting on a large scale and whites being tortured. But there were many of them, more than any other book in the late 1920s. The Tragic Era helped the Democratic Party keep the segregationists in power for another generation. It seems to me that the Tragic Era should be answered adequately, fully, ably, finally, and again, it seems to me, thou art the man. Du Bois received this encouragement to answer the book from the legendary black educator Anna Julia Cooper. Du Bois dove into his research for the book he later considered to be his best, better even than The Souls of Black Folk. America could never have a truthful history until we have in our colleges men who regard the truth as more important than the defense of the white race, Du Bois concluded, in Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880, published in 1935. Far from a tragic era, Du Bois argued Reconstruction was the first and only time the United States had ever truly tasted democracy. After the Civil War, black and white commoners came together to build democratic state governments providing public resources for ordinary Southerners. White elites overthrew these governments by securing the loyalty of white commoners, a feat accomplished not by offering them higher wages, but by holding up the rewards of the lucrative public and psychological wage. From Du Bois, historians now term these rewards the wages of whiteness. They were the benefits that would accrue to whites through application of racist ideas and segregation. And to receive them, white laborers needed only stand shoulder to shoulder with white elites on lynched and raped and exploited black bodies. To a New Yorker reviewer, Du Bois took the odd view, in distinction to most previous writers, that the Negro is a human being. Du Bois's Reconstruction history changed or swept away our familiar scenes and landmarks, wrote the reviewer for Time. But Du Bois did not blunt the appeal of the tragic era among Southern segregationists. It is unlikely that racist readers would have their minds changed by a black scholar. Indeed, it would take the legitimacy of a white historian and native Southerner, historian Howard K. Beale of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, to break the consensus of Columbia's Dunning School in 1940. Though his book certainly helped, Claude Bowers did not necessarily need to write The Tragic Era to break the back of the Republican Party. On October 29, 1929, the stock market crashed, ending the decades-long dominion of the pro-business GOP. The Great Depression hit the South and black America particularly hard. No jobs for niggers until every white man has a job became the Deep South slogan. In the North, black migrants and natives were often found standing on slave markets, as these street corners were called in northern cities. White employers would come by and choose the cheapest day laborers. Sexual and fiscal exploitation was rampant. In the midst of the Great Depression, with so many Americans suffering, it became harder to embrace eugenics, harder to blame one's economic plight on hereditary factors. Assimilationists took advantage of this lull and continued to assume control of the scientific community. Franz Boas blasted segregationists in his presidential address before the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1931. Princeton psychologist Carl C. Brigham confessed in 1932 that his earlier findings about IQ tests determining genetic black inferiority were without foundation, although the use of Brigham's SAT tests only expanded. Scientific disciplines split into bickering factions, with geneticists distancing themselves from eugenicists. Meanwhile, eugenics was kept afloat by Nazi Germany and by the American Birth Control Movement, the latter run by Margaret Sanger and her American Birth Control League. Physical anthropology, a discipline studying biological racial distinctions, had split off from cultural anthropology, which studied cultural distinctions. Boas was at the helm of cultural anthropology. The anthropologists at the helm of physical anthropology were Ernest A. Houghton and Carlton S. Kuhn at Harvard. In 1931, Houghton authored Up from the Ape, which became a staple in physical anthropology courses over the next few decades. Physical characteristics, Houghton explained, which determine race are associated, in the main, with specific, intangible, and non-measurable, but nevertheless real and important, temperamental and mental variations. Many of Houghton's students entered the healthcare sector, where segregationist ideas of biological races were rampant, and where workers were still treating diseases differently by race. Syphilis harmed blacks much more than it did whites, argued syphilis expert Thomas Merle in Journal of the American Medical Association in 1910. But this theory had never been definitively proven. So, in 1932, the U.S. Public Health Service began its study of syphilis in the untreated Negro male. Government researchers promised free medical care to 600 syphilis-infected sharecroppers around Tuskegee, Alabama. They secretly withheld treatment to these men and waited for their deaths so they could perform autopsies. Researchers wanted to confirm their hypothesis that syphilis damaged the neurological systems of whites while bypassing blacks' underdeveloped brains and damaging their cardiovascular systems instead. The study was not halted until the press exposed it in 1972. Hootens, up from the ape, received a compliment when King Kong appeared on the big screen in 1933. The film shares the adventure tale of a colossal, primordial, island-dwelling ape who dies attempting to possess a young and beautiful white woman. Americans scraped their pennies together, took their minds off the Depression, and gave the film stunning box office sales. Reviewers were captivated. One of the most original, thrilling, and mammoth novelties to emerge from a movie studio, radiated the Chicago Tribune. Actually, King Kong was nothing but a remake of The Birth of a Nation, set in the island scenery of Tarzan, and then New York. But King Kong did not invite the controversy of The Birth of a Nation. The filmmakers had veiled the physically powerful black man by casting him as the physically powerful ape. In both films, the Negro ape terrorizes white people, tries to destroy white civilization, and pursues a white woman before a dramatic climax, the lynching of the Negro ape. King Kong was stunningly original for showing images of racist ideas without ever saying a word about black people, like those Southern grandfather clauses, poll taxes, and understanding clauses that had disenfranchised black people. Black critics struggled to condemn King Kong, but they had no trouble launching an attack on NBC's radio comedy program, Amos and Andy. More than 40 million white and black listeners tuned in nightly in the 1930s to hear the perfect song from the score of The Birth of a Nation, and then Amos and Andy came on. The stereotypical characters included coons, toms, mammies, and even a nagging, assertive, emasculating Sapphire, the first major media representation of an angry black woman. While racist listeners laughed at the characters, anti-racist listeners laughed with them, especially the profoundly likable and imperfectly human main characters played by two white minstrel show veterans who shared the relatable troubles, fears, frustrations, and restrictions of urban black life in the Great Depression. Those African Americans who turned up their noses at Amos and Andy usually also despised Hollywood's first black celebrity, Stephen Fetchit, who played a series of roles depicting the laziest man in the world. Stephen Fetchit starred in Hearts in Dixie, 1929, the first studio production to boast a majority black cast. He was clever, for in all of his laziness, Fetchit's characters hardly ever did any work, and the exasperated white characters were compelled to do the work themselves. Anti-racist blacks loved Fetchit's character. He was a trickster of racists, hearkening back to slavery's tricksters. Economically depressed black folk had to find some way to eat, some way to lessen their oppressive workloads in the nastiest and most taxing jobs, even if it meant feigning laziness. They did not find much help from the government, receiving the same old deal of racial discrimination. NAACP chapters tried to assist, but their membership and resources took a drastic plunge, and the association's national office was busy heading away from Du Bois and the struggles of poor black folk. Chapter 27, Old Deal. W.E.B. Du Bois did not share the vision of the new executive secretary of the NAACP in 1933, Walter White. Du Bois envisioned an association of common people like the Scottsboro Boys, the nine black teenagers falsely convicted in 1931 by an all-white Alabama jury of gang-raping two young white women on a train. These poor, dark, unschooled, unassimilated teens, whom activists around the world rallied to free, did not necessarily suit Walter White's vision. He wanted to transform the NAACP into a top-down litigating and lobbying outfit that put refined folks like himself before courts and politicians to persuade the white judges and legislators to end racial discrimination. Walter White, who sometimes passed as white, envisioned what a young, doubly conscious Du Bois had envisioned. But in 1933, a 65-year-old Du Bois had almost completely turned to anti-racism. Du Bois escaped the internal battles of the NAACP offices for a 5-month visiting professorship at his old stomping ground, Atlanta University. With the Great Depression spinning nearly every thinker onto economic matters, Du Bois taught 2 courses that spring semester of 1933 and mailed off 2 pieces to the crisis on Marxism and the Negro. Howard's orthodox Marxist economist Abram Harris begged Du Bois to reconsider his intertwining of Marxist and anti-racist ideas, saying that Marx had not fully addressed the racial issue, despite his famous declaration that labor in a white skin can never be free as long as labor in a black skin is branded. But the present depressing reality, not an old theory, convinced Du Bois it was time to break ground on the ideology of anti-racist socialism. In one of the 1933 articles, he described the United States as a post-Marxian phenomenon with a white working class aristocracy. At the end of the decade, Du Bois would expound on his anti-racist socialism in Dusk of Dawn, 1940. Instead of a horizontal division of classes, there was a vertical fissure, a complete separation of classes by race, cutting square across the economic layers, Du Bois put forward. The vertical cutting knife was constructed of centuries of racist ideas. This flat and incontrovertible fact, imported Russian communism ignored, would not discuss. Du Bois' anti-racist socialism reflected his disenchantment with not just capitalism, but assimilationist thinking. In June 1933, Du Bois challenged those HBCU educators who were copying white college curricula during a commencement address at his alma mater, Fisk. Du Bois knew Thurgood Marshall's class of 1929 at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania had overwhelmingly voted against the acquisition of black professors and Negro studies, explaining their votes through racist ideas. The anti-racist calls for Negro studies at Negro colleges kept coming from Du Bois, from Langston Hughes, and from the 1926 architect of the popular Negro History Week, Carter G. Woodson. In his 1933 book, Woodson called attention to the subject. In his title, he called it The Miseducation of the Negro. It was well understood that by teaching of history, the white man could be further assured of his superiority, Woodson wrote. If you can control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his action. If you make a man feel that he is inferior, you do not have to compel him to accept an inferior status, for he will seek it himself, and if there is no back door, his very nature will demand one. And so assimilationist black scholars were demanding the back door, decelerating the advance of Negro studies in the 1930s. The more anti-racist W.E.B. Du Bois became, the more he realized that trying to persuade powerful races was a waste of time, and the more certain he felt that black people must rely on each other. What probably solidified the need for black solidarity in Du Bois's mind the most was studying the remedies for the Great Depression coming out of Washington. After taking office, President Franklin D. Roosevelt powered through what he called the New Deal, the flurry of government relief programs, job programs, labor rights bills, and capitalism-saving bills passed from 1933 to 1938. To secure the congressional votes of Southern Democrats, Roosevelt and Northern Democrats crafted these bills such that, to Southern blacks, they seemed more like the Old Deal. Just like in the old days before Roosevelt, segregationists were given the power to locally administer and racially discriminate the relief coming from these federal programs. And segregationists made sure that farmers and domestics, blacks' primary vocations, were excluded from the law's new job benefits, like minimum wage, Social Security, unemployment insurance, and unionizing rights. Not to be denied, black Southerners secretly joined sharecropper and industrial unions, organized inside and outside of the CPUSA to fight for their own New Deal in the 1930s. Alabama blacks during the Depression blended their homegrown anti-racist socialism and Christian theology in a popular saying, "And the day shall come when the bottom rail shall be on top and the top rail on the bottom. The Ethiopians will stretch forth their arms and find their place under the sun." Northern blacks joined the Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO, that emerged in 1935. Some unions supported them in their dual fight against capitalism and racism. Other unions handed black workers the old deal. In order to join the unions, the Negroes will have to forget they are Negroes and stop talking about that race stuff. These racist unions refused to do what could bring that about, eliminating racial discrimination. Next to employment, there may have been no more devastating area of discrimination than housing. The Roosevelt administration's new Homeowners Loan Corporation, HOLC, and the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, handed black residents the old deal when these agencies drew color-coded maps coloring black neighborhoods in red as undesirable. The maps caused brokers to deny residents new 30-year mortgages and prevented black renters from purchasing a home and acquiring wealth. But, of course, the discrimination was ignored or discounted, and the fiscal habits of black people were blamed for the growing fiscal inequities and segregation created by the policies. Discrimination for blacks and government assistance for whites won the day. Although they received disproportionately less than whites, black Americans, especially Northerners, did receive some assistance from the New Deal, more than they had from any other federal government program in recent memory. Grateful black Republicans flocked to Roosevelt's Democratic Party. They were enticed also by Roosevelt's famed black cabinet of 45 blacks in his administration. But no one endeared black Americans more to the Roosevelt administration, and thereby to the Democratic Party, than FDR's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt. In 1934, the First Lady publicly endorsed the anti-lynching measure lying in Congress's intensive care unit. She befriended the only woman in the black cabinet, Mary McLeod Bethune, and the NAACP's Walter White, and rejoiced about the black gifts of art and of music and of rhythm that come by nature to many of them. President Roosevelt made 1933 a pivotal year in the economic history of the United States, pushing through a series of economy jump-starting bills during his first 100 days in office. It could have also been a pivotal year in the racial history of the United States, but Roosevelt was too beholden to his party's segregationists. Meanwhile, powerful blacks were too beholden to assimilationist or persuasion tactics for Du Bois's igniting articles to spark an anti-racist movement. In the September 1933 issue of The Crisis, Du Bois published On Being Ashamed, a look back at the lifelong course of his own thinking, which he generalized as black America's thinking. From emancipation to around 1900, the upper class of colored Americans, he said, had striven to escape into the mass of Americans, practically ashamed of those who were not assimilating. But since then, colored America has discovered itself, and Du Bois had discovered himself and his singular anti-racist consciousness. Again, in the November crisis, Du Bois admonished the large number of American Negroes who, in all essential particulars, conceive of themselves as belonging to the white race. And then, in the January 1934 issue, he surprised readers who were used to his integrationist politics by publishing segregation. Following Marcus Garvey, Du Bois distinguished between voluntary and non-discriminatory separation and involuntary and discriminatory segregation. Opposition to voluntary black separation should not come from racist ideas, he insisted, or from any distaste or unwillingness of colored people to work with each other, to cooperate with each other, to live with each other. Scores of black newspapers reported reactions to the pieces, which ranged from approval to confusion to rage. Assimilationists who finally felt they were making some headway desegregating northern white America, religious believers in uplift suasion, and those who were stubbornly committed to the political racism that black advancement can only come from white hands all looked upon Du Bois as a traitor. The vast majority of the Negroes in the United States are born in colored homes, educated in separate colored schools, attend separate colored churches, marry colored mates, and find their amusements in colored YMCAs and YWCAs, Du Bois went on to argue in 1934. Instead of using our energy to break down the brick walls of white institutions, why not use our energy refurbishing our own? Du Bois's bosses at the NAACP and the presiding officers of the National Association of Colored Women did not agree. Among the older or richer or more assimilated or more doctrinaire voices of the talented 10th, Du Bois was slipping, as the Philadelphia Tribune editorialized. But with each essay, Du Bois was winning the respect of a new generation. Carter G. Woodson, Zora Neale Hurston, Mary McLeod Bethune, and Langston Hughes all agreed with his assessments. And to the unionized Southern sharecroppers, the migrants laughing at Amos and Andy, Stephen Fitchett, and the workers and students preparing to organize the National Negro Congress and its youth offshoot, the Southern Negro Youth Congress, Du Bois had never been better. Bolstered by this support, Du Bois swung back at the critics who believed that assimilation and accomplishment by Negroes could break down prejudice. "This is fable," Du Bois thundered in the April 1934 crisis. "I once believed it passionately. It may become true in 250 or 1,000 years. Now it is not true." Du Bois never again seriously promoted uplift suasion. W.E.B. Du Bois knew he was entering the eye of one of the deadliest political storms in modern times when his train rolled into Berlin on June 30, 1936. The New Atlanta University professor was on a research trip after being pushed out of the NAACP for advocating black empowerment instead of integration and assimilation. It did not take long for Du Bois to write home that the Jew was the Negro in Germany's second year of Adolf Hitler's chancellorship. 11 days before Du Bois' arrival, the German-born Max Schmeling had squared off at Yankee Stadium against the pride of African America and the scorn of segregationist America, the undefeated Brown Bomber, Joe Louis. Since the days of Jack Johnson, white masculinity had attempted to redeem itself not just through Tarzan, but by classing black boxers like Joe Louis as the magnificent animal, as the New York Daily News dubbed him before the bout. Stunningly, Schmeling knocked Louis out, inspiring the cheers of white supremacists from Brooklyn to Berlin. 2 years later, Louis avenged the loss in the racial fight of the century. Hitler aimed to project the supremacy of Aryan athleticism through hosting the 1936 Summer Olympics. The disinterested Du Bois remained away from Berlin for much of August, but Jesse Owens, a little-known son of Alabama sharecroppers, made history at the Games. He sprinted and leaped for 4 gold medals and received several stadium-shaking ovations from viewers, Nazis included. When Owens arrived back in the States to a ticker tape parade, he hoped he had also managed to change Americans' racist ideas. That was one race he could not win. In no time, Owens was running against horses and dogs to stay out of poverty, talking about how the Nazis had treated him better than Americans. If anything, Jesse Owens' golden runs deepened the color line, and especially the racist ideas of animal-like black athletic superiority. Racist Americans refused to acknowledge the extraordinary opportunities blacks received in sports like boxing and track, and the fact that a disciplined, competitive, and clever mind, more than a robust physique, was what set the greatest athletes apart. Instead, athletic races served up an odd menu of anatomical, behavioral, and historical explanations for the success of black sprinters and jumpers in the 1932 and 1936 Olympics. It was not long ago that his ability to sprint and jump was a life and death matter to him in the jungle, explained University of Southern California legend Dean Cromwell, Owens' Olympic track coach. But Jesse Owens did not possess the Negroid type of calf, foot, and heel bone that supposedly gave blacks a speed advantage, Howard anthropologist W. Montague Cobb found in 1936. Since some track stars could pass for white, there is not a single physical characteristic, including skin color, which all the Negro stars have in common which definitely classify them as Negroes. Cobb did not receive many admirers in the United States, where people were convinced about the benefits of natural black athleticism and biological distinctions. Almost everyone still believed that different skin colors actually meant something more than different skin colors. His 6 months of cultural sightseeing, of learning about the political economies of Germany, Japan, China, and Russia, came to an end. In the second week of January 1937, W.E.B. Du Bois set his eyes on San Francisco Bay from the deck of the Tatsuya Mara. He once again entered the United States where Franklin D. Roosevelt had forged a commanding coalition of liberals, labor, enfranchised northern blacks, and southern segregationists to win the most lopsided presidential election in history. Fearful of alienating segregationists, Roosevelt did not use his power to ram the anti-lynching bill, which was still on life support, through Congress. If you succeed in the passage of this bill, Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo resounded on January 21, 1938, in opposition, then raping, mobbing, lynching, race riots, and crime will be increased a thousandfold, and upon your garments will be the blood of the raped and the lynched. Bilbo proposed black colonization abroad and praised the doctrines of Nazi Germany. But it was those very Nazi doctrines and the mass murders of German Jews, which began in 1938, that were enraging white intellectuals and turning them off from Jim Crow. In December 1938, in a unanimous resolution, the American Anthropological Association denounced biological racism. In denouncing racism, scholars first had to define it. Beginning around 1940, Columbia anthropologist Ruth Benedict, a student of Franz Boas, dropped the term racism into the national vocabulary. Racism is an unproved assumption of the biological and perpetual superiority of one human group over another, she wrote, in Race, Science, and Politics, 1940. She excused her class of assimilationists from her definition, though. All those women and men who assumed the cultural and temporary superiority of one human group over another. As assimilationists took the helm of racial thought, their racist ideas became God's law, nature's law, scientific law, just like segregationist ideas over the past century. Assimilationists degraded and dismissed the behaviors of African people and somehow projected the idea that they were not racist, since they did not root those behaviors in biology, did not deem them perpetual, spoke of historical and environmental causes, and argued that blacks were capable of being civilized and developed. Aside from Benedict's Race, Science, and Politics, the most influential assimilationist scientific text of the era came from E. Franklin Frazier, the former student of assimilationist Robert Park. In 1939, the Howard University sociologist published a definitive study entitled The Negro Family in the United States. In his introduction, Frazier expressed a debt to Du Bois's Atlanta University study on the Negro American family 30 years prior, when Du Bois had concluded that sexual immorality is probably the greatest single plague spot among Negro Americans. Du Bois returned the compliment by praising Frazier's brilliance as a black sociologist, showing some of the holdover of his assimilationist ideas. Frazier painted broad strokes of the urban, non-elite black family as an ugly, disordered, matriarchal albatross. He described absent fathers and unmarried working mothers leaving their children alone, sons growing into criminals, and daughters learning to imitate the loose behavior of their mothers and transmitting moral degeneracy from one generation to the next. In Frazier's sexist view, male-headed nuclear two-parent families were ideal. In his racist view, black families statistically fell short of white families in fashioning this ideal. This disorganized family life in black neighborhoods was caused by racial discrimination, poverty, cultural pathology, and the introduction of the matriarchal black family during slavery. Completely stripped of his cultural heritage, the slave became a brute, Frazier argued. The slave's emergence as a human being was facilitated by his assimilation of his master's culture. And now, black assimilation of the more formal aspects of white civilization is ongoing in urban areas, Frazier concluded. Intermarriage in the future will bring about a fundamental type of assimilation. E. Franklin Frazier was hardly alone in his assimilationist preference for becoming white. Psychologists Mamie Clark and Kenneth Clark found that the majority of the 253 black children in their study in 1940 and 1941 preferred the white doll over the dark doll. Junior high school students associated light to medium skin tones with intelligence and refinement, and dark tones with meanness and physical strength. The lighter the better paralleled the assimilationist idea of the straighter the better. Since the 1920s and the craze of the conch, short for the recipe called congoline, black men had joined black women in straightening their hair. One teenager, Shorty, gave his friend from Michigan his first conch in Boston in 1941 or 1942. "We both were grinning and sweating," Malcolm Little remembered. "He stood there, looking in the mirror, lost in admiration of my hair now looking white." 2 decades later, Malcolm X reflected on his first really big step towards self-degradation. "When I endured all of that pain, literally burning my flesh to have it look like a white man's hair. Malcolm by then realized that he had joined that multitude of Negro men and women in America who are brainwashed into believing that black people are inferior and white people superior, that they will even violate and mutilate their God-created bodies to try to look pretty by white standards. The sudden willingness to describe racism more accurately did little to obliterate it, especially in popular culture. In 1939, MGM released Gone with the Wind, based on Margaret Mitchell's Pulitzer-winning 1936 novel. Gone with the Wind shared the story of the strong-willed daughter of a Georgia enslaver pursuing a married man. Scarlett O'Hara's lack of morality aside, the white enslavers are portrayed as noble and thoughtful, the slaves as loyal but shiftless and unprepared for freedom. African-American protesters failed to stop the movie's success. It was almost universally praised by white film critics for its superb cast of actors and actresses. Characters that seemed, oh, so real, bringing the old Georgia plantation to life before their eyes. The film smashed box office records as hard as it smashed the truth of slavery, and it received 10 Academy Awards. It supplanted The Birth of a Nation as a box office leader, becoming the most successful film at the box office in Hollywood history. In the same way that Tarzan became the primary medium through which Americans learned about Africa, Gone with the Wind became the primary medium through which they learned about slavery. The only problem was that, in both cases, the depictions were woefully incorrect. The loyal, loving Mammy in Gone with the Wind, one of the most adored characters in Hollywood history, was played by the actress Hattie McDaniel. By enjoying her servitude, Mammy acts as a healing salve for a nation ruptured by the sins of racism, political scientist Melissa Harris-Perry explained in a 2011 analysis of the film. McDaniel received an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, a first for a black person. After Hattie McDaniel, Hollywood producers loved to wrap bandanas around dark and hefty mammies in a parade of films in the mid-20th century. The stereotype masculinized black femininity while emphasizing the ultra-femininity of their white counterparts on the screen. Light-skinned black women saw either exotic or tragic mulattoes on movie screens. These characters failed to be assimilated into white womanhood and failed to seduce white men. In the face of these racist caricatures, W.E.B. Du Bois clung to the promise of a group of young black writers he met in Chicago in 1940. One feels a certain sense of relief and confidence in meeting such sturdy pillars of the day to come, Du Bois glowed to New York Amsterdam news readers. It was his first time meeting the sturdiest pillar of all. Born and raised in Mississippi, the 31-year-old pillar had migrated to Memphis and then had gone on to Chicago, where he acquainted himself with the work and students of assimilationist Robert Park. Richard Wright, who mused on the cultural barrenness of black life in his autobiography Black Boy, 1945, proved to be the novelistic equivalent of sociologist E. Franklin Frazier. Both gave the United States powerful exhibits into American discrimination. Both benefited from the North's intellectual march onto the assimilationist avenue during the Depression. Wright echoed Frazier's racist historical account of enslaved Africans being stripped of their culture and their gradual dehumanization to the level of random impulse and hunger and fear and sex, as Wright said to a friend in 1945. Northwestern anthropologist Melville Herskovitz disputed this theory in The Myth of the Negro Past in 1941, bringing on the critical wrath of E. Franklin Frazier. African culture was no less resilient than European culture, and the cultural exchange went two ways, Herskovitz maintained. African Americans created a strong and complex culture of European outward forms while retaining inner African values, he insightfully argued. Those who had consumed the myth of the Negro past were suffering from race prejudice. Anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston was one of the few black intellectuals writing for popular audiences who was not suffering from this race prejudice, this cultural assimilationism sweeping the academy in the 1930s and the 1940s. Since her youthful days in Harlem's Niggerati, Hurston had struggled to make a living as a woman writer, and a black woman writer at that. She had worked for a New Deal jobs program designed to put writers back to work, but had received less compensation than less qualified white writers. She had gone on to release Mules and Men, 1935, the finest collection of black folklore ever recorded. Mules and Men did not fit in the canon of media suasionist works that showed either harsh or stereotype-defying black life, thus upsetting Howard University literary scholar Sterling Brown. Instead, Hurston's collection revealed the unique, varied, and imperfect humanity of Southern black folk. Mules and Men seemed almost like a non-fictional appetizer to the novel Hurston released in 1937. The new book carried the indelible title, Their Eyes Were Watching God. In it, Hurston guided readers into the depths of rural black culture in Florida through a protagonist named Janie Mae Crawford. After escaping the domineering confines of two well-off but domineering men, Janie marries and finds love in the much younger and much humbler Tea Cake, and finally feels her soul crawl out of its hiding place. Their Eyes Were Watching God explores the precarious love life of a heterosexual black woman at the intersection of sexism and racism. "Honey, the white man is the ruler of everything as far as I've been able to find out," Janie's grandmother tells her. "So the white man thrown down the load and tell the nigger man to pick it up. He pick it up 'cause he have to, but he don't tote it. He hand it to his women folks. The nigger woman is the mule of the world so far as I can see." Hurston chose neither to glorify nor denigrate Southern black culture, probably knowing that media suasionists and assimilationists would be upset with her choices. But Hurston hardly cared. Instead, she took a revealing shot at the lunacy of black assimilationists through her construction of Mrs. Turner, a friend of Janie's. Anyone who looked more white-focused than herself was better than she was in her criteria, Hurston narrated. Mrs. Turner, like all other believers, had built an altar to the unattainable, Caucasian characteristics for all. Her god was Smiter, would hurl her from pinnacles and lose her in deserts, but she would not forsake his altars. Hurston did not sell many copies, despite the largely positive and racist reviews from white critics. The novel reflects normal Southern Negro life with its holdovers from slave times, its social difficulties, childish excitements, and endless exuberances, according to one New York Times reviewer. Their Eyes Were Watching God is filled with a limitless sense of humor and a wild, strange sadness, hailed the New York Herald Tribune's reviewer. While racist whites enjoys Hurston's depictions of every Negro who isn't so civilized that he has lost the capacity for glory, to quote a reviewer from the New York Herald Tribune, Elaine Locke, the godfather of media suasion, demanded that Hurston stop creating these pseudo-primitives who the reading public still loves to laugh with, weep over, and envy. Richard Wright, drowning in all of his cultural racism, unable and unwilling to see her missives of anti-racist feminism, and unable to see the politics of her love story, said the novel carries no theme, no message, no thought. It only exploited the quaint aspects of black life. It was like a minstrel show in a book, Wright maintained, satisfying the tastes of white readers. Hurston did not need to respond to these black male critics. "I am not tragically colored," she had already told the world. "There is no great sorrow dammed up in my soul, nor lurking behind my eyes. I do not mind at all. I do not belong to the sobbing school of Negrohood, who hold that nature somehow has given them a low-down dirty deal, and whose feelings are all hurt about it." But the sobbing school was selling out books. By the end of the decade, Their Eyes Were Watching God was out of print, and Hurston had to find work as a maid. Hurston was ahead of her time. When her time came in the 1970s, long after her death, an anti-racist feminist rediscovered Their Eyes Were Watching God, they fittingly partook of their own self-defining love affair like Janie. They self-defined the novel's greatness in a literary world rejecting it, unabashedly thrusting the once-rejected novel into the conversation as one of the finest, if not the finest, American novels of all time. In criticizing the greatest anti-racist novelist of the interwar era, Richard Wright made a way for himself. When W.E.B. Du Bois first laid his eyes on Wright in 1940, he was laying his eyes on the author of Native Son, a novel Du Bois admired. Native Son received a Book of the Month Club award, and it made Wright the toast of the literary world in the 1940s. The novel's main character, the bewildered and bewildering Bigger Thomas, represented many Negroes who had become estranged from the religion and folk culture of his race, and lived so close to the very civilization which sought to keep them out, Wright explained. Bigger Thomas was hovering unwanted between two worlds. Thomas ended up killing both worlds, as embodied in the calculating rape and murder of his black girlfriend and impulsive murder of a white girl. Through Bigger Thomas, Wright offered a gripping assimilationist ultimatum in Native Son. If African Americans were not allowed into white civilization, then they would turn violent. By the end of March 1940, Native Son had sold 250,000 copies and garnered rave reviews from whites and blacks alike, more sold books and rave reviews than Hurston and Langston Hughes had received in 2 decades. Wright seemed untouchable until a 24-year-old upstart Harlem writer began his literary coup with an essay called Everybody's Protest Novel in 1949. This literary lightning bolt struck media suasion and the assimilationist underpinning of social protest fiction with its original cornerstone, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, and its latest cornerstone, Native Son. In overlooking, denying, evading the complexity of black humanity for persuasion's sake, these protest novels were fantasies connecting nowhere with reality, wrote James Baldwin, 5 years before releasing his finest novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain. Like Stowe's Uncle Tom, Richard Wright's Bigger Thomas tragically admits that possibility of his being subhuman and feels constrained, therefore, to battle for his humanity. What blacks needed to do was infinitely more difficult. They had to accept their imperfectly equal humanity, Baldwin declared. It is the peculiar triumph of society and its loss that it is able to convince those people to whom it has given inferior status of the reality of this decree. All these literary battles played out during and after the Second Great War. It was a war that ended with the global triumph of American power. It ended with the need to convince the decolonizing world of the reality of the newest American decree, that the United States should take its place as leader of the free world. Chapter 28. Freedom Brand. Like many activists, W.E.B. Du Bois reeled from the height of the Nazi Holocaust of Jews and other non-Aryans. After the United States entered World War II in 1942, Du Bois felt energized by Black America's Double V campaign. Victory against racism at home and victory against fascism abroad. The Double V campaign kicked the civil rights movement into high gear, especially up north, and the long-awaited comprehensive study of the Negro financed by the Carnegie Foundation kicked it into yet another gear, especially down south. In 1936, Carnegie Foundation President Frederick P. Keppel had briefly considered some white American scholars when he had decided to heed Cleveland Mayor Newton Baker's recommendation to sponsor a study on the infant race. But there was almost no consideration of Zora Neale Hurston or the elder statesmen, W.E.B. Du Bois and Carter G. Woodson. Although white assimilationists and philanthropists were taking over the racial discourse in the academy, they were customarily shutting out black scholars as being too subjective and biased to study black people. It was amazing that the same scholars and philanthropists who saw no problem with white scholars studying white people had all these biased complaints when it came to black scholars studying black people. But what would racist ideas be without contradictions? Carnegie officials drew up a list of only foreign European scholars and white officials stationed in European colonies who they believed could complete the study in a wholly objective and dispassionate way. They ended up selecting the Swedish Nobel laureate economist Gunnar Myrdal, bringing him to the United States in 1938. With $300,000 in Carnegie funds, Myrdal employed a classroom of leading black and white scholars, including Fraser and Herskovitz, seemingly everyone except Hurston, Du Bois, and Woodson. In his two-volume, nearly 1,500-page study, published in 1944, Myrdal shined an optimistic light on what he termed, in his title, an American dilemma. He identified the racial problem as a moral problem, as assimilationists long had since the days of William Lloyd Garrison. White Americans display an astonishing ignorance about the Negro, Myrdal wrote. Whites ignorantly viewed Negroes as criminal, as having loose sexual morals, as religious, as having a gift for dancing and singing, and as the happy-go-lucky children of nature. Myrtle convinced himself and many of his readers that ignorance had produced racist ideas and that racist ideas had produced racist policies, and therefore that a great majority of white people in America would be prepared to give the Negro a substantially better deal if they knew the facts. W.E.B. Du Bois probably shook his head when he read this passage. "Americans know the facts," he may have thought to himself as he once